Welcome to WebAx, practical web accessibility tips.
WebAx.blogspot.com.
WebAx. Website accessibility. Web standards.
Hello, and welcome to podcast number 75, Jeremy Keith Interview and Google Wave. This is your host, Dennis.
And I'm Ross.
Welcome again, Ross.
Why, thank you. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. Enjoying the fall weather here in California.
Right, right. 70 and sunny during the day compared to our 50 degrees here in Michigan. But that's okay.
That's good football weather.
It is. It is good football weather. There's been some good games lately.
Yeah, it's a pretty exciting season.
Yeah. I'm glad that U of M is actually doing fairly well. So.
Yeah, fairly well. Yeah, college football, that is.
Right.
I haven't gotten into pro football yet this year.
Yeah, me either. I tend not to. I don't know why.
Mm.
Maybe if the Lions did better, I would, but. I don't see that happening.
Anyways, okay, so welcome everybody. We have a special podcast today, an interview with one of my heroes, Jeremy Keith. Fortunately for you, Ross, you did the interview. I wasn't part of it, but
next time.
I think it came out really well, and yeah, if you're unfamiliar, Jeremy is the author of the book Bulletproof Ajax, where he introduces the Hijax technique that I so dearly love.
Yep, very important for accessibility.
Yeah, and he does a lot of, you know, writes a lot of articles and speaks all around the world.
Yep. So stick around, you'll enjoy it, I assure you.
Yeah, and we're also going to talk about Google Wave. But first, just wanted to mention, we're going to go through a few news items and articles. But first, I wanted to mention a couple other articles and interviews going around. So, actually, there's a couple emails. One from Nancy White, and she sent me a quick email about an article that seemed pretty interesting. I just thought I'd give it a quick mention. 15 podcasts that will make you smarter.
Yeah. And I don't listen to any of them, I noticed, as I kind of went through them, so maybe I should.
Well, that doesn't mean you're not smart.
We could all pick up a few IQ points here and there, I'm sure.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to.
Interesting stuff. The Naked Scientist from Cambridge.
How can you tell through a podcast?
The Writer's Block, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Yeah, some good stuff. Let's check that out. Got an email from Sandy Wasmer, and I'll have to put her Twitter ID in here. That's how I know her from our web accessibility tweets and stuff. But she sent me a link to an interview that she did, and she interviewed Martha Lane Fox about digital inclusion. And let's see, it's about this charity, Action for Blind People. It's a charity in the United Kingdom that works towards, quote, a world in which blind and partially sighted people have the same rights, responsibilities, and opportunities as everyone else. Check out the interview. There's a transcript also. And this Action for Blind People is a neat little website, so you got to check that out.
Yeah, it sounds like they're doing good things, so I'm definitely going to look a little more into it and see what they're doing. Seems like they have a whole set of podcasts, so.
And Sandy's a good follow, so I'll put her the link, of course, in her Twitter ID and on this podcast blog post.
WebAx.
Okay, some news and article items to go through.
Yep.
If you haven't heard, the Obama administration unveiled a makeover for the recovery.gov website.
Yep, and we had actually reviewed the recovery.gov website a while back for accessibility. So if you haven't listened to that, take a listen and then take a look at the site now and kind of think, see what you think about it. And it sounds like we're going to review it again.
Yeah, I think maybe the next podcast we can review a few sites, including this one. We'll do a re-review.
Right. See how much they've improved and what's better and what's not, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We'll probably pick a couple other ones.
Yes. And speaking of reviews, Joe Dawson wrote an accessibility review for this petscontained.com website. And, or I got it opened here somewhere.
Yeah, it's a great review. I mean, he really goes in depth, you know, talks about making a purchase and how that kind of plays out in the whole experience and how they can improve. So, you know, it's a real nice long review. And I hope that the Pets Contained takes a look at it, because, you know, that's a lot of value there, almost like a full accessibility audit.
Yeah, really. And this article is on the, it's not on his blog, it's on the Practical E-Commerce website. He posts articles there periodically. So it's Insights for Online Merchants is the subtitle of that site. It's an excellent site, and Joe makes a great contribution to that website, so check it out. Yeah, he goes into details in some of the areas he suggests to improve accessibility is kind of the same old story, unfortunately.
Right. But, you know, anybody who has, like, an e-commerce site can take a look at this and see what are the common things that are other people are having as far as troubles, and really could get a lot out of it that way, too.
Yeah.
So I bet, you know, a lot of e-commerce shops do the same thing and could see this and say, oh, you know, we should fix that.
So he mentions, like, five main things to look at. He says simplify the alt attributes in the main navigation menu. Edit templates to provide proper HTML headings. Add skip links. Rewrite forms to provide explicit labels.
Yeah, and I think that's a big one. You know, people don't pay enough attention to their forms.
So check out the article. I don't think we need to get any further detail.
Yep. And it looks like WebAIM has a screen reader user survey.
Yes, and most of you may know about this already. It's been out for a little while now. But basically, the month of October, it's a follow-up, you could say, to last year's screen reader survey. So if you use a screen reader, please go there and take the survey. Any contribution you can give is valuable. As we know, WebAIM, you know, a lot of people are going to look at the results of the survey, as WebAIM is one of the main leaders, world leaders in web accessibility.
Yep. So I'm sure this information kind of helps them promote and improve accessibility.
Yeah, and they need to know which direction to go, right? Like,
right. So as leaders, yeah, they need this sort of information. So the more people that contribute and, you know, are willing to take a little bit of time out of their day, the more accessible the web can be for everybody.
Well said.
Thank you. And then I wrote an article called How Many People Is Your Website Alienating? And I forget where I got the idea, but I just looked at all the different statistics I could find as far as percentage of people who had various accessibility needs, and kind of took a look at just really how many people you could be alienating by not paying attention to accessibility.
Excellent. Did you design this website?
No, actually, I took it over a while ago, and it was already had a design.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So I kept it.
Cool. Yeah, I noticed, is this some CSS3 going on with text shadows?
Yeah.
Very
and actually,
cool.
Yeah, for those interested, I actually just did another article about how to use CSS3 to create a cool-looking button that degrades nicely. So.
Oh, yeah?
In any browser that supports some of these CSS3 elements, you get drop shadows and rounded corners and 3D text. And if not, it still looks like a nice little button.
WebAIM. Okay, let's move on. Google Wave. Jared Smith of WebAIM did an accessibility review of Google Wave, at least the preview of Google Wave.
Right, so, which I have not seen yet, unfortunately. Or I've seen video, I just haven't had a chance to actually use it.
Yeah, well, it's overrated. So I finally got an invite just a few days ago. I wasn't too impressed with it in general. I mean, it seemed like a, you know, just like a super high-powered chat client or something. But as far as accessibility goes, yeah, Jared Smith wrote a really tactful article, maybe too tactful. But he does list more than several, like, items that, you know, can use improving. Apparently... me and many others on Twitter had a fun time ripping into it. It really did, you know, lack web accessibility. You could tell, I mean, I thought they were going to use HTML5 and it was going to be, you know, at least have headers and, like, you know, something.
Right.
You know, be somewhat accessible, you know, maybe lacking a few things. But, I looked at the code the other day. It said HTML4. And yeah, it's just, I don't know what Google's thinking. With all the money that they have, you think they could, you know, consider accessibility a little more.
Right. I wonder if it's one of those things where, you know, the people who are working on it just want it to actually function, and they're not really thinking about the practicality of it. You know, they just want...
A lot of companies do that, and it's totally not excusable. It's just... okay, right. We got this deadline, we have to just make it work and just get it out the door and forget about everything else, you know. But, I mean, Google needs to set an example.
Yeah.
Like Yahoo is doing, you know, with web accessibility and standards. Yahoo's doing a great job, and unfortunately Google's not.
Right.
Recently they came out with this, Google came out with this accessibility homepage or something. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
I thought. But.
Yeah. For how much they do and all the different products and that they're able to come out with, I mean, the amount of effort that it would take them to spend a little bit more time to make it accessible would really not be that much. It's just I don't know if they just don't care or what.
Yeah. But anyways, if they plan for accessibility and standards in the beginning, like they should, they have the time, there's no hurry, they have tons of money. They have the talent. Well, at least we think they have the talent. they should have the talent.
Right.
At least they should be putting in headings and stuff, right?
Right.
But anyways. Oh.
Yeah. With how much they're shaping the way the web is going, you know, they really should take a leadership position. You know, you get companies like Adobe that really put a lot of effort into making, like, Flash accessible and stuff like that. It's kind of disappointing that Google's just not doing it.
Yeah. In Adobe, there's a great presentation you could watch, Building Accessible Flex in Adobe Air Applications.
Yeah.
I'll have to put that link in here. Let's see. Okay. But anyways, let's go through some of the items in Jared's list here. Alternative text is not provided for any images.
Background images are used to convey content.
Role states and other accessibility properties are not defined.
There's no document or heading structure or semantics. None. Not even a list.
Form elements do not have labels or titles.
I couldn't believe that one. Keyboard focus indication is hidden. making keyboard navigation nearly impossible.
This sounds like they're trying to not make it accessible purposely.
Right.
Most interactive elements are not in the tab order or do not respond to keyboard activation.
Keyboard focus is often trapped, requiring the page or browser to be closed to resume keyboard navigation.
The application becomes unusable and unreadable when text size is increased only slightly.
Yeah. That's some pretty major stuff. And I understand it's still in closed beta or whatever they're calling it, but...
Yeah, but like, alt text,
right.
Keyboard navigation, forms, headings, these are like the most basic things.
Yeah. Why would you hide keyboard focus? I can't think of any reason.
Who knows? Anyways, okay, well, if you have any other feedback, if we're missing something, please leave a comment on the blog. And if you get any Google Wave invites, send one to Ross.
Yes, please. I'd like to try it and see all these horrible things that I've only read about.
Okay, so let's move on to Ross's interview with Jeremy Keith.
WebEx.
So today we'll be talking with Jeremy Keith. You may have read his books before, one of them being Bulletproof Ajax, the other one DOM Scripting. They're both great books, very well known. You may have come across his website, Attico.com, or Addicto.
I've never Addictio. Figured out how to pronounce that.
I think it's Addictio.com.
Addactio?
Addactio?
I don't know.
I should have asked him that. Anyways. he's a web standards guru, author, and speaker, and he works for the company ClearLeft, and he's going to talk to us about how ClearLeft does things, about the future of accessibility and HTML5. So we're here today with Jeremy Keith with ClearLeft. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, Ross.
Thanks for joining us. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem.
So why don't we start, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, just in case some of the listeners could learn a little more.
My name's Jeremy. I work at ClearLeft, which is a web design, web consultancy firm in Brighton in the UK. There's 9 of us here now. And I'm a front-end developer, mostly, so doing HTML, CSS, JavaScript kind of stuff. So sitting in front of the computer all day building websites, basically.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners can relate to that situation.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about ClearLeft. What sort of projects do you work on? What is your focus?
All sorts of clients, really. It depends on the project, you know. Sometimes what we'll do is just consultancy, as in, you know, go and talk to people, give advice. Sometimes we'd go further and we'll be doing information architecture, we'll be wireframing, you know, doing workshops. Sometimes we go further again and we're doing visual design. And sometimes we go further than that and we're delivering HTML and CSS and JavaScript templates. But that's about where we stop. We don't do back-end development at ClearLeft, or not normally. There's been one or two cases where we've done a bit of it. But generally we'll work together with other companies on that side of things, depending on the project.
So there have to be a special circumstance to really kind of do that sort of work?
Yes, it's not really our speciality. We've all kind of specialized in other areas like UX design, visual design, front-end development, that kind of thing. So what tends to happen with companies that do back-end development is that you will decide on a specific technology. Like you'll either be a .NET shop or you'll be a Ruby on Rails shop or Django shop or PHP shop or whatever. And we'd rather keep our options open when it comes to the actual technology we use for anything. Although I did build a Django site recently, but it was kind of partly because I wanted to learn how to use Django. But that worked out pretty well. Maybe we'll end up doing that again. We'll see.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard a lot about Django lately, and I actually have a colleague that uses it exclusively, so it seems to be gaining some steam in the community.
Yeah, it was actually good fun figuring it out. Well, it was a roller coaster ride, you know. I had tearing my hair out sometimes, but then quite amazed at what I could accomplish at others. Certainly a learning experience.
Right, right. Most new technology tends to go that way, huh?
Yeah.
And ClearLeft also has a software product?
That's right. We built a Mac software product called Silverback, and that's for usability testing, quick and dirty usability testing. And as with most things, that came about from us scratching our own itch, because we believe very strongly in doing usability testing. We've seen ourselves the great, great value we get from doing usability testing. But the problem was always getting usability tests set up when you're trying to organize a computer and something and a video camera to do the recording and all this kind of stuff. There are some products out there. There's a Windows product called Moray, but that's a few hundred pounds, I think, to buy. So we thought, we could do something quick and dirty. It was Andy Budd had the idea, that seeing as just about every Mac these days has an iSight built in, you've got the video camera, and if you took what was being recorded on the video camera and you took what was happening on the screen and you put the two together, then you've got a record of somebody using a website, and you get to see the person's face as they use the website and hear what they're saying as they use the website. So just put two together into a product called Silverback, and we were able to release it relatively cheaply. It's like $50, and it certainly scratched our itch, and we use it ourselves when we're doing usability testing, and from all the feedback it's been useful for other people as well, which is quite gratifying. But it was an interesting project, because we don't build Mac OS X software, so we had to hire somebody to build the actual software. And that was interesting, because then we were in the position of being the clients, where normally we're used to dealing with the clients. So it was kind of good to get the other perspective on that.
Right. It's always interesting to have the roles reversed.
So yeah, exactly. Get the other perspective.
Right. So did you do kind of all the front-end design and planning at ClearLeft and then just outsource the actual development, or did they assist in that way as well?
Yeah, no, we did the design of the actual app here, and of course we did the website ourselves. But so we were doing the visual design and the interface design, and then worked with a freelance developer to implement that.
Gotcha. Well, let's move on to some accessibility-related questions, because this is an accessibility-related podcast. And you've always been a large advocate of web standards. How do you feel that accessibility fits into web standards? Are they the same thing, or are they different? Why or why not?
They're definitely not the same thing. I think they are quite different, but historically they've gone hand in hand. Simply because I think the mindset of a person who wants to do the right thing and believes in doing something correctly from a quality point of view, which means web standards generally, is usually also the kind of person who wants to do the right thing from the moral point of view, which means accessibility. So historically, I think the two have been linked because the same kind of person would want to do web standards and accessibility. But the two aren't intrinsically linked, in my opinion. So when people talk about web standards, they're generally talking about, using CSS for styling and keeping the markup nice and clean. And the benefits there, I don't particularly see them as being accessibility benefits. I think there's great benefits for workflow. There's great benefits for, getting your work done faster, for working together with other developers, for being able to restyle things quickly and easily. But I don't think there's any direct accessibility benefits. Now, using good markup, there are direct accessibility benefits, using good headers and, good document structure, but that's certainly not the reason why people would be using web standards by itself. That's usually like an associated benefit. So, I don't think they're connected. I certainly don't think they're the same thing. There's a kind of historical overlap, simply because I think they appeal to the same kind of person.
So you think, in theory, somebody could create an accessible website without web standards?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, we have to define what web standards is. I mean, technically, using HTML2 or HTML3.2 is a perfectly fine web standards. Not using CSS can be using web standards as well, because HTML is a web standard by itself. But, yeah, I mean, it is possible to use tables for layout and still have an accessible website, for example. So the two don't necessarily go hand in hand. But the incidences of, let's say, people using not best practices when it comes to markup and styling, overlapping with good accessibility, I think would be smaller than the overlap between people using web standards and people that have, good accessible sites.
Good point. So you've written two books on JavaScript, the DOM scripting and Bulletproof Ajax. How do you feel about the latest trend of people using pre-canned JavaScript libraries like jQuery or Prototype?
Well, my opinion has changed over time. I mean, this trend has been going on for quite a while. It really started around about the time that DOM scripting itself came out. That was about 2005, and already by then people were starting to use libraries. And at first I thought, well, I'm not sure I'm keen on this idea of libraries, that, you know, people basically using them like a black box, not understanding how JavaScript works, just sort of plugging in the library, crossing your fingers, hoping it works, and it works. Hey, great. And I thought, oh, people should understand. People should know how things work under the hood before using a library to make life easier. And to a certain extent, I still feel that today. I feel that people should have a basic understanding of what the DOM is, what the document object model is, before using a library. But I also understand the position that developers are in. You know, it's you gotta get that website out the door by Friday. The clock is ticking, and this library can promise you to save you a lot of time by doing the legwork. So from that point of view, I understand it. And also, in the intervening years, there's been a great shakedown in libraries, really, that things have basically trickled down to just a handful of strong libraries. I mean, a few years ago, it seemed like there was hundreds, literally hundreds of JavaScript libraries. And how would a developer know which one to use? How would a developer know which was a good library, which was a bad library? And these days, when people talk about JavaScript libraries, they're generally talking about a handful. They're talking about jQuery, Prototype, YUI, MochiKit, you can pretty much name them on the fingers of both hands. So they are all pretty good. I mean, they've all got good communities. They've all got good documentation. If a developer uses any one of those libraries, they can be pretty well assured it's going to work well. It won't have any hidden gotchas and bugs that are going to catch them out. So things have changed over time. The libraries have changed over time, and so my position towards libraries has also changed over time. I've softened towards them. And I use libraries myself, to save myself reinventing the wheel all the time. It just makes a lot of sense to use libraries. I do still feel in the back of my mind that I think people should have a certain basic conceptual knowledge of what JavaScript is and what the DOM is before they use libraries.
So you've kind of seen that as they're refined and improved, they're to a point where they're pretty safe to use in most situations?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, certainly. I mean, a lot of them are put together, they're very, very smart people that put together the libraries in the first place, but now there's also very large and passionate communities making sure the libraries stay good. Sometimes you'll find where the core library has very good quality control, maybe the plugins aren't subject to the same level of quality control, so I'm still a bit more wary of just taking, say, a jQuery plugin to do something and accepting that at face value. I'd be a bit more cautious about that. But the core libraries themselves do seem to be really, really good, which isn't a surprise when you consider the people that are making them and the communities that are behind them.
So do you be more inclined to kind of develop a plugin of your own versus using one that's already out there?
No, I will generally use one that's out there, but I will do more research. I'll get some feedback on, other people who've used this library, good, bad feedback. I'll just generally be a bit more cautious and do a bit more legwork in finding out whether there are any hidden gotchas to it.
Gotcha. Do you feel that kind of the adoption of these libraries has had an effect on accessibility, even if it's just web developers not being careful in how they use them?
I think the effect on accessibility can be positive, because a lot of the time when you're trying to do things with JavaScript, a lot of it's emulation, right? You're trying to do things in a browser that the browser wasn't really intended to do, but together with HTML, CSS, JavaScript, you can create things that work like the desktop. You can create controls that work very similar to other pieces of software that aren't in the browser. And that's all fine, but it's still emulation. And to get that working in an accessible way, which means you're going further than simply emulation, you're making sure that under the hood these controls are accessible, are being exposed correctly to assistive technology, that's quite tricky to do. But a lot of the libraries are doing it by default. So Dojo, that's quite a big, hefty library. That is for making real sort of web apps that happen to live on the web. That's got, a lot of built-in accessibility hooks there, you know, with ARIA. And jQuery is going the same way. And they've got a whole accessibility sort of team there, specifically working on integrating ARIA and YUI the same. They know about this stuff. They're smart people. So for developers wanting to do something relatively complex on the web, that the browser can't do natively, I think a lot of time it makes more sense to use a library because you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to do all the amount of research and testing and debugging that these library makers have already done. And the philosophy of the library makers does seem to be that they understand accessibility is important and it's part of the core philosophy in the libraries, and that's why they're baking it in. I mean, it's not like, say, some are further than others, but all of them certainly believe that it's not enough to just make a control that acts like a desktop control. It does need to also work under the hood in the same way as a desktop control and expose the right sort of semantics to assistive technology.
Are there some libraries that you feel are further ahead in terms of accessibility than others, or are the core ones all pretty well equal?
I have to admit, I haven't really been doing my own sort of testing on this. In my day-to-day work, I'd be using jQuery because I find the philosophy of jQuery fits well with me. But then on my day-to-day work, I'm not doing anything that's too complex. I'm generally doing a few little JavaScript effects, a few little controls, but nothing really complex. Some of the other libraries would be better if I were building, you know, the next Gmail or the next Google Wave or something. You know, things like Dojo are more suited to that. From what I've heard, it's those kind of more heavy libraries that have really thought about the accessibility hooks. And from the sound of it, YUI also has some really good ARIA support in there, and jQuery is getting better all the time. But I myself haven't done any kind of side-by-side comparison to see how well they're doing.
And when we're using JavaScript with a library without, what sort of things should we worry about or think about or test to ensure that things are accessible?
Well, it's tricky because what I test for generally with JavaScript is I try and make sure that the JavaScript isn't required. In other words, that whatever the functionality of the page or the app is, that functionality is available without JavaScript. So that I can submit a form, that I can follow a link without requiring JavaScript, that I can complete my task without requiring JavScript. And that if you approach JavaScript that way as something that you add on, sort of layer on top to make things smoother, to make things easier, that's generally a good, robust approach to JavaScript development on the web. Now, that's not necessarily anything to do with accessibility. I think it's a good start because it shows you're thinking about, well, what happens in this situation when JavaScript is switched off. But that's obviously a very different situation to someone using a screen reader, because someone using a screen reader, they have JavaScript. The screen reader sits on top of a web browser, usually Internet Explorer, and that web browser has JavaScript enabled, therefore they have JavaScript enabled. But the way that the JavaScript gets communicated to the screen reader is kind of iffy depending on the events, and particularly with Ajax. So it's not enough to just be thinking about what happens when JavaScript is switched off. That's a good start, but it's not enough to just think about that. So these days, when dealing with any kind of interaction, the JavaScript-driven interaction, I think you can start looking at ARIA and start looking at the hooks that ARIA allows you to put into your markup to specifically expose what a control is supposed to be. You know, this control acts like a slider, and this part of the page acts like a, you know, an area where feedback messages will be shown, error message will be shown, that kind of thing. ARIA's, you know, is made specifically for that purpose, and seems to be doing a really good job of it. And the browser support is getting good now, so I think it's at the stage where you can start implementing this stuff and you'll do pretty well with it.
Do you think that when you get to the point of a full-blown web application, should you really be required or seriously consider doing accessibility testing, or is following kind of the ARIA standards and that sort of thing enough in most cases?
I think it definitely gets more challenging. The further you get from document and the closer you get to an app, very much like a desktop app, the more challenging all of this stuff gets. Not just the accessibility side of it, but the whole behavior side of things and making things intuitive and making it feel like a desktop app. It definitely gets tougher. It has gotten easier now that ARIA does make that kind of thing easier, but I have to say, in a lot of the cases today, right now, if I wanted to build an app like that, I probably wouldn't use HTML. I probably wouldn't use HTML and JavaScript. I think I might do it in Flash because that's what Flash is for, right? And Flash does have, you know, inbuilt accessibility hooks that you can use. So I'm not so sure that everything needs to be HTML and JavaScript. Now, that may change in the future as HTML evolves and gets, you know, better at being a language for web apps and not just web documents. But right now, if I wanted to build, yeah, the next Google Mail or the next Google Wave, I'm not so sure I would do it necessarily in the browser.
Interesting. And yeah, Adobe has gone a long way to make the Flash platform a lot more accessible. It just seems like there's more education to be done. You know, people have to kind of understand how to do it a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I was one of the people who needed educating. It was quite funny, actually, because I was talking to my friend Aral Balkan, who's a JavaScript developer here in, or sorry, a Flash developer here in Brighton, amongst other things. And just a few years ago now, but we were down on the beach having a barbecue, and he's talking to me about JavaScript because he hasn't touched JavaScript since the late 90s. And I'm talking to him about Flash because I haven't touched Flash since the late 90s. And we both realized that our perceptions of these technologies had been frozen in the late 90s. So he thought that JavaScript was this really sort of buggy, inaccessible language that worked completely differently in different browsers and was really hard to code. And meanwhile, I thought that Flash was this completely inaccessible technology that was just good for, you know, whizzy movies and Flash intros. But in fact, in the intervening years, both had moved on, but neither of us had kept an eye on the other technology. So he was educating me about all the things you could do in Flash, you know, like detecting the presence of a screen reader and adding in, you know, hooks for assistive technology. And I was telling him about JavaScript and how these days it's all standardized and works pretty well. So, education, I've seen it firsthand with myself. You know, I needed to be educated about how Flash has changed.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation because I get the impression that some people try and recreate the capabilities of Flash using JavaScript now when really Flash could be a better platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ideally when you're approaching a problem and you're trying to solve the problem, what you should think is, well, what's the best tool for solving this problem? What actually happens is people fall back on what they know. So, you know, the likelihood is here, clear left, because we know HTML and CSS and JavaScript, we're likely to use HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to try and solve that problem. When really what we should be doing is stepping back and saying, hang on, maybe Flash is the best solution here. But likewise, you've got a web agency that's an all-Flash agency. They're likely to just approach every problem from the point of view of how do we do this in Flash, instead of sometimes saying, well, actually, in this case, it might be better to use HTML or JavaScript or CSS. So yeah, ideally, you know, you take the right tool for the job. In reality, what happens is there's inertia because you use what you're used to.
Very true. So you talk a lot about graded browser support. Where do you think we should draw the line? I mean, particularly in instances where maybe the client doesn't understand the importance, as long as it looks good on their screen?
Yeah, so, well, the nice thing about graded browser support is that it's graded. So it's not so much that you draw the line, you draw many lines. And that's the nice thing about it. We're not simply talking about which browsers do we support, because seeing it in that kind of black and white binary Boolean way just isn't useful. Because then when you talk about, you know, do we support this browser or not support that browser, usually what you mean is something like, does it look the same in this browser as it does in all the other browsers we support? And that's just not helpful. The expectation that sites can or should look the same in all different browsers is just unrealistic and it's going to lead to heartbreak. So the question of support, I think, kind of goes back to what I was saying about when I'm developing any kind of JavaScript, is I ask myself, can this task be accomplished? You know, whatever the task is, you know, filling in a form, completing a transaction, writing a blog post, whatever the task is, can I accomplish this task in this browser? And what I try and do is make sure that the answer to that question is yes in as many browsers as possible. Going right back to a text-only browser like Lynx, or an ancient browser like Netscape Navigator 3 or Netscape Navigator 4, you know. Now, of course, the experience won't be the same, but the trick is understanding that that's okay. So it's usually pretty clear with the really old browsers, like I say, Netscape 4, you know, IE5 probably. It's understood it's not going to look the same in that browser. It probably won't work the same in that browser, but I still feel the user should be able to accomplish their task in that browser. Where it gets tricky is with the more recent browsers, where the differences are more subtle. So then you're talking about little enhancements, like certain CSS3 effects that you can add in Safari and Firefox that just won't be seen in Internet Explorer. And is that okay? And I personally think, yeah, that's absolutely great. I think it's perfectly acceptable that, you know, a more advanced web browser gets a slightly nicer look and feel. And yeah, I have heard this argument that, oh, but what about the clients? You know, the clients will push back on this. That hasn't been my experience. I think that's a theoretical pushback to this issue. In my experience, clients have been okay. And if clients do push back, then, you know, we'll talk about it and we'll arrange something. It might involve, you know, rearranging the budget slightly if the scope is now that everything has to look just as good in Internet Explorer 6, for example. But I haven't actually come across the problem of, oh, clients will want it to look the same in every browser. Clients generally are pretty smart, savvy people, and they understand how things work. In fact, generally what I've gotten from clients is more that they're pleasantly surprised that a site can still work in a really old browser, even though it won't look the same, but the fact that the users will be able to accomplish their task if you do things in the right way. So in the question of, you know, where do you draw the line, it's more like where do you draw the various different lines. And that's where graded browser support is really useful, because it doesn't just split browsers into browsers we support and browsers we don't support. It has these levels of support, which just makes so much more sense to me.
Do you spend a lot of time educating clients on kind of the situation and the process and how to approach graded browser support, or is it something that comes up when it comes up?
Not really. I mean, ideally, we would talk about it at the start of a project. If it's an existing site, you want to look at their stats, and that should inform your decision for what browsers you want to give the best support to, what browsers it's kind of safe to give a degraded experience to, I suppose you could call it. So at the start of the project, it should come up. Generally, though, the technical aspects of the site itself, you know, the technical details of what technology is being used to build a site, isn't that important to clients usually, and neither should it be. I mean, they shouldn't have to care about HTML or PHP or any particular web technology. What they should care about is, you know, the site accomplishing tasks. It should be about, you know, allowing their users to accomplish the tasks they came to the site to do. And that's what we spend most of our time talking with clients about, and I think that's rightly so.
So to switch topics, how do you think HTML5 is going to impact accessibility?
I think HTML5 is going to be very good for accessibility. For the one main reason is that ARIA is getting integrated in there, which is great. I've already sung ARIA's praises. I think it's very good. And for a while there, it did look like there was kind of a hostility to ARIA from the HTML5 group, from the What Working Group. Partly, I think, because it was created at the W3C, kind of behind closed doors, so the process of the creation of ARIA wasn't ideal for, you know, a group of people who pride themselves on the openness. But it's a good spec, it's solid, and most importantly, it's implemented. And this really trumps anything when it comes to trying to convince the HTML5 guys of anything. If there's an implementation, that counts for a lot. So the fact that so many browsers now implement ARIA, you know, including Internet Explorer 8, which is just fantastic, and so many screen readers, you know, have support for it, that really made a no-brainer that ARIA would get integrated into HTML5. There's still a few hiccups, you know, to deal with exactly how do browsers treat certain situations. So, for example, in ARIA, it's perfectly legal to say input type equals radio, role equals checkbox. Okay, that's technically possible. Now, what's a browser supposed to do? Treat this input as a radio or a checkbox? So there's those kind of little fine tunings, little hiccups to be sorted out, but on the whole, it's in there. Now, for me as an author, the reason why this is great is that I can now write my HTML and start using these ARIA roles and have my markup validate. I can run it through the W3C validator, which uses an HTML5 validator if it's used the HTML5 doc type, and it won't complain about the ARIA roles. If I do that with HTML4 or XHTML1, the validator will complain, which is okay. I mean, you can just ignore the errors coming up in the validator, but that's kind of, you know, gives you a niggling feeling at the back of your mind. Ah, I hate the fact that it's not coming up valid. But with HTML5, I can have my cake and eat it too. I can write HTML and use ARIA's roles in there and have it validate. So for me, I think it's encouraging the adoption of ARIA, and that can only be a good thing. And also, I mean, there's other benefits for accessibility, but they're more theoretical right now. They aren't implemented. So the idea of having new elements specifically for structure, like nav, for example, is going to be really handy for assistive technology, where instead of us having to do our skip to main content or skip navigation links in our documents, that will all be taken care of by the user agent. The browser will be able to skip the navigation, skip straight to the main content. So all of that kind of stuff will be valuable. And then also the fact, all the stuff that we've been doing by emulation that I was talking about earlier, all these web apps were emulating the desktop. A lot of that stuff will become browser native with HTML5. So for example, there's a lot of different form controls, input type equals range, input type equals date. And the idea is that the user agent itself will pop up a calendar widget or will show a slider widget whenever it sees one of these input types, which we can do now using, you know, HTML and CSS and JavaScript, but it is emulation when we do it now, and it's tricky to make that stuff accessible because it is emulation. So as soon as that stops being emulation and starts being browser native, then those controls are getting exposed as part of the operating system as a native control, and that's always going to be so much more easier for assistive technology to hook into. So on the whole, everything is positive as regards accessibility in HTML5. The talk about accessibility in HTML5, though, appears to be negative. If you do, you know, a little bit of Googling, and you Google the words HTML5 and accessibility, you see negative comments, which is surprising. And they seem to be about really, really small things. So there was a big discussion about the alt attribute in images and whether it should be required, as in if you don't use it, you have an invalid document, or whether it should be optional, kind of recognize a lot of people don't use it, or there's cases when there might be a good reason not to have an alt attribute. And there was a huge debate about that. And more recently, there's been a huge debate about the summary attribute on tables, which isn't, you know, a very commonly used attribute and isn't the most important thing when it comes to accessibility. And it kind of got misappropriated as a talisman for people, where people actually wanted to talk about the HTML5 process. And they felt that the HTML5 process was circumventing other working groups, such as the accessibility working group, the W3C, and that was the issue that they actually had, rather than the summary attribute itself. So it's actually kind of funny, because if you look at where all the discussion has been around HTML5 and accessibility, it's been around small things like the alt attribute, summary attribute, the long desk attribute. And those seem like such trivial things in comparison to the really big problems that have yet to be solved. And by really big problems, I would include things like video. You know, trying to make a video element that is natively accessible, building in accessibility hooks for video. And Canvas. Canvas is a huge, huge issue, which is intended for dynamic images, you know, bouncing circles and lines and all that cool stuff, but is actually starting to already be used for text. You've got things like Bespin, which is a text editor that uses Canvas. And of course, none of that text is really text in the DOM, so it's just completely inaccessible to assistive technology right now. And those are things that need to be worked on. Those are big issues, video and Canvas. And yet, that's not what people are talking about. To the large degree, people are talking about small things like alt and summary and stuff like that, or about the process. And they're not really getting stuck into the real challenges, which is Canvas and video, which it seems a bit of a shame to me.
Do you think part of it is that it's easier to look at something and think that it should be done differently than try and find a solution for something that needs a solution?
Can you give me an example of what you mean?
Well, for example, you're talking about the alt attribute, and people could maybe thinking that, well, it should be required because it encourages the use of accessibility. I would do it differently. But in the case of Canvas or video, it's really a problem because there is no proposed solution.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the thing. It's certainly easier to discuss and to argue about things like the alt attribute and summary, because you can grasp hold of them and you can look at the data and you can be an expert in this kind of stuff because it's already out there and you can have, you know, an opinion on it and back it up with experience. Whereas, yeah, something like video or Canvas, that's a much, much tougher cookie to crack. So I guess it does make sense that people will gravitate towards the low-hanging fruit, I suppose, which would be things like the alt attribute summary, rather than the really sort of monolithic problems like Canvas and video. That is a fair point. Some people are, you know, trying to tackle the bigger issues of video and Canvas, and I wish them the best of luck, because I think that's a very, very tough problem.
Yeah, myself as well. So, as web developers, should we start considering to use HTML5, or should we be worried about the proposed adoption date and Internet Explorer's kind of shaky support for it?
Well, I mean, the thing is, when you say use HTML5, you don't mean using the whole spec, because when we use HTML4, we don't use the whole spec. Or we don't use every element that's in the spec when we write an HTML document. We use the bits that work. So I certainly think you can use HTML5, because most of HTML5 is simply HTML4. Most of what HTML5 is doing is taking the existing spec of HTML4, throwing away a few things, adding in a few other things, and mostly just defining error handling, which is hugely, hugely important. So defining how browsers handle malformed markup. So most of HTML5 is simply HTML4. So you can start using HTML5 today by just swapping out the doctype, just writing doctype HTML. That's it, instead of the long doctype you're using now, whether it's HTML4 or XHTML1. So certainly authors could do that. They could just straight away just swap out the doctype, boom, that's it, they're using HTML5. Run it through the validator, everything should still be working just as before. As I mentioned, though, you get a couple of benefits as soon as you do that. One of the benefits being now you can start using ARIA roles, and you can start using ARIA roles and still have your document validate. So from my point of view, I find that a good enough reason to use HTML5 already. Now, when it comes to using the new elements in HTML5, that's a different question. Now, there I would be more cautious. So there's new structural elements like header and footer and nav and section and all these kind of things. And I'm not using those new elements yet, partly because the spec isn't done yet, you know, things could change, but mostly because the implementation isn't there. Like you mentioned, Internet Explorer wouldn't do anything with those elements. There are JavaScript hacks you can use to get around it, but still, you know, it's a little bit iffy. So what I tend to do is I'll take the semantics from HTML5. So this idea that you have an element that's a nav element or an element that's a footer element, and I'll take those names and use them in classes. So I'll say div class equals nav, div class equals footer, div class equals header. So as an author, I'm getting used to the idea of these HTML5 structures. I'm still using backwards compatible markup, though, but with the class element. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. And then further down the line, I could swap them out for the actual elements once the spec has, you know, steadied down and once the implementation gets better. There's some nice things. Some of the newer elements, they degrade very, very nicely, which is really useful. So, for example, with the audio and video elements, you got your opening audio tag and your closing audio tag, or your opening audio, video tag and your closing video tag. And what you put in between the opening and closing tags is what a browser will see if they don't understand audio and video. So that means if you've been using Flash to deliver audio or video up till now, you can still do that. So you open your audio tag and you put in the stuff that, you know, more modern browsers that support audio will understand. And then before you close the audio tag, you put in your old Flash content. So it's already got that sort of degradation built in. And another example of that would be these new form elements I was talking about. So you've got input type equals search, or input type equals date, or input type equals range. Well, in just about every browser, if you put input type equals anything and it doesn't recognize what it is you're saying, it will default back to type equals text, which is exactly what you want. So it doesn't break or it doesn't flag up error. It simply shows a normal text input. So I've already started to do that, for example, with input type equals search. Safari will do something with that. It will treat it like the search in iTunes or Mail or Safari itself. Style it nicely with that little magnifying glass. But every other browser, you'll just see a text input. So there's no reason not to use input type equals search in that case. So I'm generally more cautious with actually using the new elements. But certainly I've started using the doctype and I've started getting used to the structures. Because what really matters isn't any particular date about when a specification is done. what matters is when browsers are supporting things, and there's a lot of stuff already supported by browsers. It's kind of the same with CSS. We don't wait till a CSS specification is done. We use whatever the browsers are implementing. So there's parts of CSS 3 that are available now because browsers are implementing them, and I'll use them because they work now. So specification dates aren't that important to web developers or browser makers for that matter. It's what's working right now that matters. Also, this date of 2022 that's been bandied about is just a lot of FUD, basically. The 2022 date refers to the date when there should be two completely interoperable implementations of HTML5. And it sounds like it's very, very far away, 2022. But actually, it's very, very, very ambitious to expect to have even two completely interoperable versions of HTML5 in browsers by that date. Because there aren't, you know, two completely interoperable versions of HTML4 in browsers. And that's been around for a long time. You know, browsers handle things differently. They do error handling differently. In Internet Explorer, it didn't support the abbreviation element until Internet Explorer 8. Right, so there wasn't even complete support for the spec there. So these dates just aren't that important. If you are looking at the dates, then the important one for HTML5 will be 2012, because that's when it's candidate recommendation status. And between 2012 and 2022 is basically when there must be browsers out there doing it, getting better all the time, with the expectation that by 2022 you would have two complete implementations, absolutely complete, every I dotted, every T crossed. So it is actually a very, very ambitious date and quite close, really. But mostly those dates just aren't relevant. What's relevant is what works, what can I use right now?
Right. So like people kind of took a look at the two dates out of the wrong perspective rather than looking at the whole situation.
I think people took them people were kind of scared about having to learn new stuff, which is understandable. I mean, a web developer's life is pretty hard, and hearing, oh, there's new technology coming down the pipe, I've got to learn more stuff, can be kind of scary. And if you did a little research and you saw this 2022 date, it was very easy to go, oh, okay, I don't need to worry about HTML5 now. It's years and years and years in the future, so I'm not going to worry about it now. And that's a shame. And actually, it's kind of dangerous, I think, because then there's the danger that web developers are simply going to get and pass by people who are investigating the stuff and who are keeping up with it. So it's definitely worth investigating now. Don't wait.
Right. It's almost like when tables were still very common and people kind of waited and put off learning CSS because it was difficult.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that very much. There's a local mailing list here in Brighton that's still going strong. And I remember back in, 2001, somebody would post a message list, how do I do this? You know, some particular thing they were trying to do in a web page. And I would usually post back, because at this stage I was all into my CSS and web standards. So I would post back, well, here's how you do it in CSS, and I'd show some code. And inevitably some people would come out of the woodwork and say, CSS, forget about it, it'll never take off. And look, tables work, right? They work now, they work today, which is true, they did. You know, you couldn't argue with that. Tables work just fine. They had great support in all the browsers. But I distinctly remember a couple of years later, when the very same people who had been saying, tables work, you should just forget about CSS, were coming on the list and saying, how do I do this in CSS? You know, here's something I'm trying to do. So, given enough time, it's going to happen. So it's just a matter of, do you want to be in on the ground floor or do you want to be playing catch up later on?
Right. What challenges do you see HTML5 facing beyond kind of some of the accessibility questions that haven't been answered?
Well, so the accessibility ones are huge, I think. I mean, I think the big challenge is Canvas, video also. Personally, I think that maybe even Canvas could be split off into a separate specification, because that's already happened with some other complex parts of HTML5. Apart from that, it's basically getting the browser makers on board to implement this stuff. And most of them are part of the working group themselves, so it's simply a matter of time. Of course, it's not going to be evenly distributed. That's going to be the issue. You're going to have, browsers like Safari and Mozilla and Opera implementing a lot of this stuff quite quickly and basically competing on how fast they can implement this stuff, which is really good to see. But you're going to have Internet Explorer lagging behind, as usual. And so as a web developer, that's going to restrict when we can start using this native stuff. So that's going to be a challenge. But on the whole, I would say the biggest challenge facing HTML5 would be the accessibility issues around Canvas and video to a certain extent too.
So to switch gears, how does Clear Left go about educating clients on the importance of accessibility?
We don't. We don't talk about it. It's one of those things where it should just be a given. If you have to talk about it, it's kind of weird. You know, if, you know, the plumber comes to your house and then says, hey, listen, is it okay if I use this particular wrench to fix your sink? And you say, well, why are you asking me that? You're a plumber. And then you start thinking, well, is there something about that wrench I should know? You know, is this a controversial wrench to be using? We don't talk about the accessibility side of things. We just do it. It's kind of a given. I remember Jeff Veen talking about this a few years back. He, a very controversial post he wrote, I don't care about accessibility, which is a controversial title, but what he actually meant was, same thing, he expects it by default, and he doesn't care about it in the sense of he doesn't want to spend time talking about it. And that's certainly the way we feel. It should just be accessible from the get-go, and it's not something you talk about. The same way we don't talk about web standards with our clients. We don't talk about what doc type we'll use or what kind of CSS we'll be using to build a site. We're just going to go ahead and build a site. I mean, maybe it's going to come up if there's specific implementation issues, like a particular behavior, a particular piece of interaction that would definitely have accessibility side effects, then we would mention it and we'd bring that up. But usually, we certainly don't discuss it with clients. It's just expected.
There's never situations where a client notices something that maybe you did for accessibility reasons and asks for it to be changed?
Not that I can recall. I'm kind of racking my brains now, but I don't recall that it's ever happened. Generally, there's not much we do specifically for accessibility reasons because there's such a huge convergence between usability, accessibility, search engine optimization, all these kind of benefits you get from best practices in general, that there's not much we would do specifically for accessibility. Like, say, you just kind of expect it to be there by default. They've noticed when we've done things, you know, they'll notice when they get good Google search engine rankings, for example, and that wouldn't have been something we would have advertised to them as something they were going to gain, but they'd be pleasantly surprised by that. And that's usually as a result of things that are also good for accessibility, right? Good logical page structure, good markup, good headings. But they usually don't talk about the accessibility side of things at all, really. And I can't recall having had to remove something that was an accessibility feature. Because you see, the way I think about accessibility isn't usually in the sense of making sites accessible, right? Adding on accessibility features like that. It's more like keeping sites accessible, because the way that, you know, screen readers work with HTML, for example, HTML is by default accessible. If you put a web page on the web and it's got a good HTML structure, it's accessible. Then you can screw up that accessibility by adding stuff. You go in with your JavaScript and other stuff, and there's potential there to screw up the accessibility that was there before. But it's not like you go in and you add accessibility on top of the document. The document was already accessible. So I tend not to think about adding things for the sake of accessibility, more how do we keep this accessible? And every time I want to add something, I think, will this affect the inherent accessibility that the document already had? So from that point of view, there aren't really things in there that have been added for the sake of accessibility.
Interesting. The instance that's come up with me a few times as a client has noticed the tooltip that's created by like an alt tag, and I think it's distracting. So that's usually the case where I have to educate them a little bit about the importance of alt text from both accessibility and search engine perspective.
Yeah, and I mean that is that is a bug in the browser because it's only Internet Explorer that does that.
Right.
And other browsers correctly don't show alternative content in tooltips like that. But I remember coming across that as well, again, on this local mailing list, I remember a few years ago, arguing about accessibility and somebody saying, oh, exactly that. I won't use the alt attribute because it pops up a tooltip. And I thought, that's it? That's your sole justification for not using it? You know, obviously you can work around it pretty easily, you know, put an empty title attribute in there, or wrap a surrounding element with some title attribute. It's pretty trivial, really. And it surprises me if I still come across that attitude today, because like I said, it's been a few years since I've had to argue that point.
Does ClearLeft test websites that are built for accessibility?
Not explicitly. We do usability testing, though. And, you know, if possible, it would be, you know, what we'd like to do is have at least one of the usability testers be someone using assistive technology, because not just would you then be testing for accessibility, you would be getting a usability test, like that's a turbo-powered usability test. I was at a conference last year in London. It's coming up again soon, actually. Accessibility 2.0, it's called. And I heard the same message throughout the day, which was really reassuring, that basically accessibility and usability are quite closely related, and that an accessibility test should be like an extreme usability test. So if we were testing for accessibility, it would kind of be as a byproduct of usability testing. But generally, that doesn't end up happening. It tends to be usability testing more than accessibility testing. But there is such a huge crossover that solving the issues of one tends to solve the issues of the other as well. We've done some usability audits, and that involves accessibility audits as well for some other companies. And there again, I wouldn't myself use assistive technology, because the experience would be completely different. You know, me using, a screen reader than a blind person using a screen reader. But, there's different heuristics you can use. There's different tools that are out there that we've used. Some of things like Jez Lemon's contrast checker, tools like that. But also understanding that tools will only take you so far. And really testing with people is the way to go.
Yeah, it kind of gives you a whole new perspective on not only how people use sites, but how people with assistive technology use sites.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's true of usability testing in general. Like, every web designer should be made to watch somebody, do a user test on their sites, behind a two-way mirror if possible, so that they can't be seen. But it's such a humbling experience to see somebody use something you built and you think is totally understandable and totally intuitive, and to see them struggle with it. And to see somebody using assistive technology on a site is like that experience, but even more so. And I think what both experiences do, seeing somebody use your site like that is give you a sense of empathy, which is a really, really valuable thing for a designer to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you seen any of the new kind of web tracking software that lets you see actual user sessions?
I've heard about some of these, yeah, for remote usability testing, right?
Right. I mean, you don't get any feedback, but you can actually see, like, a user scroll through the page and that sort of thing.
Oh, right, yeah. So, like, these kind of Ajax devices. Yeah, I have seen some of those. Personally, I don't find them as useful, because you don't get to see the person, and you don't get to see what the person's feeling or how the person is, why the person is doing what they're doing on screen. So it's kind of like eye tracking. Eye tracking is often brought up in the context of, user testing and usability testing. But eye tracking doesn't really tell you anything apart from where people looked on the page. And what I mean is, it doesn't tell you why they looked on the page. So eye tracking, you can interpret the same data in two completely different ways. You could say, well, people spend a lot of time on this part of the page or looking at this part of the page, and you can interpret that as being, well, that's a good thing because that's where a major call to action is, and that's good. Or you could say, well, this is really bad because it's obviously a very distracting part of the page, and they're ignoring the rest of the page. And either interpretation could be correct, but either way you're just guessing, because the correct thing to do is just ask the person or watch the person use the website, and then you would know why they're interacting with that particular part of the page, why they're ignoring another part of the page. So things like eye tracking I kind of put in the same sort of basket as those remote trackers that do the kind of Ajax tracking like that. I find them, they can be useful, but not nearly as useful, I think, as having a real person sit down and use the website and watching that person use the website.
Yeah, without kind of knowing the reason why, like you said, I could see situations where it would be very easy to draw the wrong conclusion and kind of head off in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I was talking about this with Luke Rabluski, because he does use a lot of eye tracking at Yahoo, and he had a great quote, which was that if you torture data long enough, you can get it to reveal anything.
So what advice would you have for companies or developers that want to take kind of a stronger practice for creating sites with standards and accessibility?
I would say just go ahead and do it. It's one of those things. There's a couple of different technologies out there where, people I'll be talking about them at conferences or, you know, evangelizing them, and people always ask the question, well, how do I convince, right? Dot, dot, dot. How do I convince my client? How do I convince my boss, you know, to use insert X here? Whether it's, you know, web standards, accessibility, micro formats, anything like that. And my response is usually the same. It's like, you don't have to convince anyone. Just start doing it. Just start building it that way. Don't go looking for permission to do things. Just go ahead and do them. Now, that can be tricky in large organizations where you need to get sign-off for every little thing and you have to have meetings about the meetings to have the meeting. But generally, that kind of guerrilla attitude of just going in there and doing it will get you pretty far. And I would say, just do it. Just go ahead and start doing it.
Great. So I hear you've been a long-time musician and you're currently in a band. You want to tell us a little bit about your band?
Oh, sure. It's band's called Salter Kane. And you can hear some songs if you go to our website, which is saltercane.com. And, yeah, four of us here in Brighton, myself, my wife, she's on bass, I'm on bouzouki. We've got our drummer, Jamie. He's actually a web developer as well. And Chris, who sings and plays guitar. And, yeah, we've been playing for a few years, played the occasional concert, just recorded another album's worth of material that'll hopefully be out on iTunes pretty soon. And it's good. It's good to have another another outlet, another sort of creative outlet there.
And one final question. Do you ever plan to go on tour with your band with Marcus Lillington's band from Boag World?
No, it hasn't really come up, although I suppose it's theoretically possible. What's it called? Stroke the Toad?
Yeah, Stroke the Toad.
Yeah, you know, maybe someday in the future there will be a double header. Obviously, Salter Kane will be headlining.
Of course.
And Stroke the Toad, maybe they could be our support act.
Right. They could be the opener to the opener.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for your time today, Jeremy. I really appreciate it.
No problem. That's fun.
All right, great. Well, thank you, and thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will catch you next time.
You will find the WebEx podcast and blog at webex.blogspot.com. That's WebEx.blogspot.com.